from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Greece's new government began its first week in power, there were already some major changes becoming evident in the country's foreign policy, with Athens banging heads with Brussels over the EU's treatment of Russia. RT's Kevin Owen has more.
The new Greek government's gone head-to-head with Brussels over its policy on Russia. The new PM shot down the European Council statement, which blames Russia for the escalating crisis in Ukraine. And Greece isn't the only EU country with the same objections. Let's get up to speed with this, then. In Berlin, RT's Murat Gazdiev with more. Tell us a little bit more about why Greece is so unhappy here, Murat.
This statement that blames Russia for the killing of 30 civilians in the eastern Ukrainian city of Mariupol, which was shelled recently. Apparently, the Greeks say that they were not consulted about this, that they did not give their consent to be added as signatories to that statement. RT, though, contacted the EU Council, and a spokesperson there told us that while they regret that Greece wasn't on board this statement, they say that they did consult the new Greek authorities, which, you know, begs the question of how Greece ended up as a signatory when it was against it. Nevertheless, this is the first time, apparently, that an EU Council statement has been renounced after being published by an EU member state. So it just goes to show you that the new Greek government isn't shy about, you know, letting it be known what it thinks. But it's also indicative of the differences between the new Greek government and the authorities, the establishment in Europe.
Meanwhile, Greece's new prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, has, according to the Guardian newspaper, lined up a formidable coterie of academics, human rights advocates, mavericks, and visionaries to participate in Europe's first anti-austerity government. Tsipras put together a 40-strong cabinet, clearly aimed at challenging Athens' creditors and the punitive mandatory austerity measures that are at the heart of the financial restructuring program imposed upon the country by international lenders, including the IMF and European Central Bank. But the reaction on the other side indicates that a difficult struggle may be ahead for the new government. RT's Murat Gazdiev reports from Berlin.
Greece is on an economic warpath. The people have spoken, and they've spoken against austerity, and the reaction has not left itself wanting. Perhaps the most important one to watch is the German one. Germany contributed more than any other European state to bailing out Greece, so it's no surprise that the German media is now quite worried, calling the new government in Greece a Euro monster. Others still decrying the new prime minister's radical plans. Others fretting over a possible Greek exit. But the politicians' reaction has been somewhat more measured. One spokesman has ruled out any renegotiation or debt haircut for Greece, meaning of writing off Greece's debt to its international creditors, the Troika. The economics minister has said that Greece has no choice but to follow its austerity plan, the plan it's agreed on. The finance minister's reaction, however, has been much more measured. He is sometimes called the architect of Europe's austerity, and he says while he's sick of justifying why that austerity is necessary, a possible Greek exit wouldn't shatter the Eurozone. The Eurozone would survive, he says. But this is all being described like a grand poker game in which both sides, the Greeks and the Europeans, their creditors, are testing and prodding one another, seeing how far each side is willing to go. But as in any poker game, it's not just about how much you can win. It's also about how much you're willing or can afford to lose.
Thursday was the second session of the third presidential summit of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Countries, in Costa Rica. Leaders of the coalition of 33 Latin American and Caribbean nations, representing around 600 million people, had much to say about their relations with the U.S., much of it critical. Telesur's Cody Weddle reports from the Venezuelan capital, Caracas.
Now, analysts call the event important for regional integration independent of the U.S. or Canada. Today, on the second and final day of CELAC, Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa will take over the presidency pro tempore. Leaders will also sign a 19-page political declaration focused on eradicating poverty and inequality and consolidating Latin American unity. Yesterday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro noted that Latin America is going through what he called a historic time and predicted that the 21st century will see the end of imperialism. Bolivian President Evo Morales and Cuban President Raul Castro also denounced external intervention in Venezuelan affairs and praised the region's progress towards independence from imperialism. At the summit, Raul Castro also demanded that the United States return the territory of Guantanamo and its prison and torture facility there. The president argued that restoring diplomatic relations was the start of normalizing bilateral relations with the U.S., but that in order to do that and in order for it to be possible, he argued that the blockade on Cuba had to be lifted, the Guantanamo territory returned to Cuba, radio and TV broadcasts from the U.S. that violate international norms to be halted, and the Cuban people should be compensated for what he calls the human and economic damage they have endured.
As we previously reported, there was an apparent double standard applied by the U.N. Wednesday in its reaction to two separate incidents, one involving the Israeli military and the other involving Palestinian protesters in Gaza. In the first incident, where a UN peacekeeper was killed by Israeli gunfire near Gahar in southern Lebanon, it took nearly a day and a half for UN officials to confirm that it was Israeli artillery fire that killed the Spanish soldier, Corporal Francisco Javier Soria Toledo, in violation of UN Resolution 1701, which ended the 2006 war between Israel and the Lebanese group Hezbollah. Corporal Toledo had been serving in the UNIFIL force since November 2014. Following the death of the UN peacekeeper, UNIFIL spokesperson Andrea Tanetti issued a statement which not only did not identify the source of the fire that killed the peacekeeper, it actually seemed to praise his fellow peacekeepers for not returning fire.
What has been important today is the UNIFIL Head of Mission and Force Commander, Major General Portolano, was in immediate contact with the parties to help control the situation and prevent a further escalation. That has been the main goal of the mission today in order to maintain the cessation of hostilities and to ask the parties to urge maximum restraint.
Also on Wednesday, the current president of the Security Council, Chile's permanent representative, Christian Barros Millay, issued a statement about the killing of the soldier and declined to answer a direct question from a reporter about the identity of the party responsible for his death. That despite the fact that he knew that the Israeli military was responsible.
The members of the Security Council heard a briefing by Assistant Secretary General Edmond Mulet regarding the recent incidents in southern Lebanon. The members of the Security Council condemned in the strongest terms the death of a UNIFIL Spanish peacekeeper, which occurred in the context of fire exchange along the Blue Line. The members of the Security Council expressed their deepest sympathy to the family of the fallen peacekeeper and to the government of Spain. Thank you very much.
Was there any discussion of which party killed the peacekeeper? Was it from the Israeli side or the Hezbollah side? Sorry?
We have a long discussion about this issue, but no. We will produce in the next hours a press statement.
Will it be a board of inquiry? Can you confirm that?
This was elements to the press?
Yeah, elements.
Even Spain's permanent representative, Roman Oyarzun Marchesi, appeared reluctant to place the blame on the Israeli military for its killing of the Spanish soldier in his role as a UN peacekeeper.
Just to share with you what is the Spanish position, I did express my deepest concern about the deterioration of the situation in South Lebanon, which resulted from the rocket attacks launched by Hezbollah from the UNIFIL area of operations towards Israel, and the artillery fire which followed across the Blue Line. I did condemn this serious breach of the cessation of hostilities between Lebanon and Israel in violation of Resolution 1701. Of course, I did express my strongest condemnation on the death of the UNIFIL Spanish peacekeeper, which occurred because of these events. I called on all sides to exercise utmost restraint, to respect the blue line, and to preserve the security and stability of Lebanon. And I did ask for a full investigation of the events. I also called all parties to abide scrupulously by their obligation to respect the safety of UNIFIL and other United Nations personnel. And that is what I can say at this stage.
Ambassador, which side, the fire came from which side that killed your peacekeeper? Which of the two sides was responsible
for
his death?
Well, I think I made it clear it was because of this escalation of violence, and it came from the Israeli side.
How fast do you want this investigation to happen? When do you want to?
I want Spain, as the Minister for Foreign Affairs of Spain did say today in Madrid, Spain will like a full investigation of the events.
Will you stay with UNIFIL?
Well, first it will be UNIFIL and together with peacekeeping operations department.
Will you stay with UNIFIL? Will the Spanish troops stay with UNIFIL?
Of course. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ambassador, the rule of engagement about those peacekeepers, if this happens again in the next hours, what are the rules of engagement of these UN peacekeepers? But it's...
Meanwhile, UN officials were quick to place the blame for property damage at the office of its special envoy to Gaza on the Palestinian group Hamas, when protests by Gazans distressed over their desperate conditions resulted in minor property damage. No evidence was offered by the UN officials of any Hamas role in the protests. Also at the UN Wednesday, the Security Council met to discuss the situation in Syria. Council members heard a terse statement from Syria's permanent representative over the council's failure to stop the flow of weapons and support of anti-government fighters into the country through Turkey and other neighboring nations. Syria's ambassador Bashar Ja'afari named U.S. ally Saudi Arabia as one country providing material aid to the terrorist group al-Nusra Front. He also said there were other countries involved in training and arming terrorists to fight in his country, a clear reference to the U.S. backing of anti-government forces there. We'll have more on that tomorrow. Last month, the Committee to Protect Journalists released its report for 2014, which designated NATO member Turkey as one of the world's top 10 worst countries for journalists, again underlining the country's deteriorating situation for freedom of expression and the media. Now it appears that the U.S. ally is working on another designation, the world's most dangerous place for reporters to drive in. Exactly 100 days after Press TV's Serena Shim, an American journalist, was killed in a mysterious hit-and-run collision with a cement truck in Turkey near the Syrian border, another fatal accident reportedly occurred when the vehicle carrying Japanese journalist Kazumi Takaya was hit by a truck while en route to the Askala border gate. Takaya was in the region to cover a potential hostage exchange set to take place with ISIL. No further details of his accident were available. Press TV's Shim, who was killed in October, had provided war zone coverage for Press TV in Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey, and Ukraine. Some of her reports were carried here. As we reported earlier this week, Wednesday marked the 23rd anniversary of the announcement by then U.S. President George H.W. Bush that the U.S. had won the Cold War.
By the grace of God, America won the Cold War. A world once divided into two armed camps now recognizes one sole and preeminent power, the United States of America. And they regard this with no dread, for the world trusts us with power, and the world is right. They trust us to be fair, and restrain. They trust us to be on the side of decency. They trust us to do what's right.
Exactly 10 years and one day later, on January 29th, 2002, President Bush's son, President George W. Bush, began his State of the Union address with a somewhat different message.
Mr. Speaker, Vice President Cheney, members of Congress, distinguished guests, fellow citizens. As we gather tonight, our nation is at war, our economy is in recession, and the civilized world faces unprecedented dangers. Yet the state of our union has never been stronger.
Unlike his father's optimistic forecasts of peace and plenty a decade earlier, the younger Bush offered a prediction of a far different future.
We've come to know truths that we will never question. Evil is real, and it must be opposed. None of us would ever wish the evil that was done on September the 11th. Yet after America was attacked, it was as if our entire country looked into a mirror and saw our better selves. We were reminded that we are citizens with obligations to each other, to our country, and to history. We began to think less of the goods we can accumulate and more about the good we can do. For too long, our culture has said, if it feels good, do it. Now America is embracing a new ethic and a new creed. Let's roll.
For more, we go to the second installment in our discussion with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer on international relations and security at the Center for Conservative Studies at Moscow University. We spoke with him from his offices in Moscow via Skype Wednesday.
The United States won the Cold War. I agree with that. I agree with that completely. But Bush then started to talk in that same speech about the United States as this single unitary power atop the world, which everyone trusts to wield power. Well, we see how disastrously the United States lost the peace. They lost the Pax Americana. They lost this hegemony of American power through the 90s and up through the 2000s to today. The number of wars and conflicts, invasions and occupations, regime changes, the continued giant buildup of the military in what should have been a peacetime, the interference in countries around the world, which led directly to what we today call the War on Terror. The United States lost the peace. And as a result of that, with the economies of several of the old great powers, the civilizations that were never quite fully conquered and integrated by Western colonialism and imperialism. We're taking a look at Russia, China, Iran, India, and we see an emerging Bolivarian South America for the first time in history. They are reacting to this imperial overstretch of U.S. and Western hegemony. As capital begins to shift from west to east, with globalization being the kind of the a form of suicide by the United States, where they invested so much in the creation of a Chinese economy that would carry out their production with low labor costs for them. We've seen a whole lot of factors with a result of this globalization that is leading, again, in combination with this imperial military overstretch, to the emergence of a multipolar world. And it certainly will not happen, this shift from unipolarity to multipolarity, without a lot of violence, without a lot of death, without a lot of economic and social chaos. But when we come out of it the other side, for the majority of humanity, I think it will be a better world.
Yeah, speaking to that, the majority of humanity, for example, is represented in the BRICS nations,
Yes.
You have the population of China and its economy.
Brazil, Russia, right. India, China, South Africa, and many people are including some other nations like Argentina as well to that.
Looking at it. And then, of course, you have the Russian military as a guarantor of, you know, the Russian strategic military as a guarantor of the security of that group.
Yes.
And then you have the China is running around, and Russia to a large degree also, running around the world making deals as they have been isolated. Russia has been isolated by, or attempted to be isolated by, the EU and the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's this whole legion of other countries, Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, that have also faced that. And it's sort of the dynamic when you go into a room with 10 people and you isolate each one. At the end of the day, there's 9 people and you. And that dynamic is sort of enabling, at a faster pace, the emergence of this multipolar world. I'm seeing China develop infrastructure like a new canal in Nicaragua, ports in Cuba, and elsewhere, and
a high-speed train that will run from Beijing to Moscow in 5 days,
and the transcontinental railroad across South America as well, and you know, just the opening of the Caribbean and the eastern part of South America to Russian traffic through the new canal and Chinese, and the military. I don't know what we call them, alliances, but certainly the discussions about that taking place around the world. Is the U.S. Past the point of no return in terms of being able to make diktat to the rest of the world?
I think it is. I think there's increasing evidence of that. I think the very first point you can push towards that is the conflict in 2008 in Georgia, where the U.S.-backed neoliberal and neoconservative regime of Mikhail Saakashvili, who came to power in the U.S.-backed Rose Revolution there, he tried to seize away two ethnic enclaves, breakaway republics, Abkhazia or South Ossetia. And there's a great reason, not only for a sense of national control of these territories, but also without control of them, it would have been very difficult, according to NATO's own rules, for Georgia to enter NATO. So with Western backing, with John McCain flying into Georgia, declaring we're all Georgians, they launched an assault on these ethnic enclaves where there were peacekeepers from the Commonwealth of Independent States, which included not only Russia, but Kazakhstan and a number of other Central Asian countries, Ukraine, etc. And these peacekeepers, which were UN-approved peacekeepers, were killed in the defense of these enclaves, as was their remit. And these peacekeepers originally were put into place with the approval of a previous Georgian government, because at least it ended the terrible ethnic civil war that was going on there. Russia reacted quite swiftly, and in a very small 7-day war, it pushed Georgian forces out of these enclaves, did a great deal of damage to Georgia's Western-trained, U.S.-trained and U.S.-armed and funded military to make sure that they couldn't come back and repeat it very quickly again. And then the Russian forces promptly withdrew back to these enclaves, and that was the end of the war. The U.S. could do nothing to intervene, although there was a lot of talk about it. It's revealed now that actually there was a discussion in the White House where Dick Cheney seriously suggested to George Bush and the rest of the inner circle there, the National Security Council under George H.W. Bush, that they launch an attack on Russian forces that were coming through the Rocky Tunnel into South Ossetia. And if they had, that probably would have been World War III right there.
Oh, man. Oof.
I did not believe it at the time. I mean, I remember watching all of these events very closely, and I never thought that the U.S. would actually military intervene, because we all know what that means. You know, not for the sake of a proxy war of a U.S. planted government in Georgia, which Russia did not take action to then remove, which certainly they could have if they wanted. They were within 20 kilometers of Tbilisi, and they chose not to. But we now know that the U.S. government was seriously considering launching a conventional attack on Russian forces on the Russian border.
Wow.
And that should scare everyone. That should scare everyone. And we are at another one of these situations now today in Ukraine. We have a proxy war. This is the Cold War redux, right? There's all kinds of rules changes from the original Cold War, and we know that proxy wars were a big part of that. Regime change, these overthrowing of governments by the CIA, something they do extremely well. It's always the aftermath that they always have problems with. We have a proxy war in Europe. This is something altogether new. This is a situation that puts us back on the tension levels of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and no one should think any differently. While the U.S. and Russia have no intention of going directly to war, even in the Ukraine, mistakes, misunderstandings in these situations are always what leads to potential catastrophe.
Hey, look at World War One, right?
Yes. Exactly. World War One. You know, there was all kinds of tensions, geopolitical, going on, but it was the smallest spark that set it all off. Let's go back just a second. When this Minsk agreements, then the additions of the Minsk memorandum, when these agreements were signed, neither side really had any intention of following them, right? Both sides used the ceasefire, and it was never a complete ceasefire. The Ukrainian shells were always following on Donetsk. The Novorossian armed forces, the rebel forces, were always making small maneuvers around the territory that they retain, which is really only a third of the Donetsk and Lugansk regions of Ukraine. It's a very small, if populous, area. There was never any real adherence to a ceasefire. Everyone knew that war would erupt once the winter was over, except that it didn't even wait until the end of winter. There was a lot of chatter about an attempted that the Ukraine would launch an offensive after on January 7th, which is the Orthodox Christmas Day. It didn't quite happen on that day, but it happened in less than a week later. And the way it unfolded is that primarily the Ukrainian armed forces simply began another massive artillery barrage of the cities of Donetsk and Lugansk. And civilians were dying, you know, not in a trickle of one or two a day, but by the scores again. And a lot of this fire at Donetsk, the city of Donetsk, was directed from a nearby town where the Ukrainian artillery was positioned, Pesky, through the position, atop the Donetsk airport, which was held by these Ukrainian forces that consisted mostly of this neo-fascist right sector movement. They were termed by the Ukrainian press the cyborgs. Right. And Donetsk, the authorities there, they simply could not let this continue to happen because this was indiscriminate fire that was far more often hitting the residential districts of the city and killing civilians at a ratio of maybe 9 to every one of the Novorossian militia that were killed by this artillery fire. Basically, what they are really doing right now is attempting to drive the Ukrainian heavy artillery, the multiple rocket launch systems, the Smerch and the Uragans, out of range at least of Donetsk and Lugansk cities.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.